Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today we bring you Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke.
It'll surely not surprise you that many Americans don't know that when the Federal Reserve System was created nearly a century ago, it was given the heavy responsibility of managing the money supply and key interest rates to support economic expansion without triggering inflation or a recession, a challenging balancing act indeed. Our special guest today chairs that august body, one that can rarely escape scrutiny or second guessing, no matter what it does. Ben Bernanke is now in his seventh year as chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. He was first named chairman by President Bush in 2006 and was reappointed by President Obama in 2010. Chairman Bernanke graduated with an economics degree from Harvard and a PhD in economics at MIT. He later taught 6 years at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and went on to become a tenured economics professor at Princeton. He's written 4 textbooks on economics and is among the 50 most published economists in America. Please join me in welcoming a distinguished and highly effective public servant whose views we are very eager to hear, Federal Reserve Board Chairman Ben Bernanke.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Nice to have a chance to get out of Washington once in a while. I'm very pleased to have the chance to join the Economic Club of Indiana for lunch. I note your mission is, and I've written it down, to promote an interest in and enlighten its membership on important governmental, economic, and social issues. So I'm going to give it my best shot. Before I dive in, I'd like to thank my former colleague, Al Hubbard, at the front table for helping to make this event possible. As the head of the National Economic Council under President Bush, Al had the difficult task of making sure that diverse perspectives on economic policy issues were given a fair hearing before recommendations went to the president. Al had to be a combination of economist, political guru, diplomat, and traffic cop, and he handled it with great skill. So thank you, Al. So my topic today is 5 questions about the Federal Reserve and monetary policy. Now, I've used a question and answer format in talks before, and I know from much experience and a little bit of evidence today with this small group, that people would like to hear more about the Federal Reserve, what we do and why we do it. And that interest is even broader than you might think. I'm a baseball fan, and I was very excited recently to be invited to batting practice for the playoff-bound Washington Nationals. And I was introduced to one of the team's star players, but before I could press some difficult questions on fine points of batting strategy, he looked at me and said, "So what's the scoop on quantitative easing?" So for that player and for the members and guests here today, and for anybody else who's curious about the Federal Reserve and monetary policy, I'm going to try today to ask and answer 5 questions. First, what are the Fed's objectives and how is it trying to meet them? Second, what is the relationship between the Fed's monetary policy and the fiscal decisions of the administration and Congress? Third, what is the risk that the Fed's policies will lead to inflation? Fourth, how does the Fed's monetary policy affect savers and investors? And fifth and last, how is the Federal Reserve held accountable in our democratic society? The first question on my list concerns the Federal Reserve's objectives and the tools it has to try to meet them. As the nation's central bank, the Federal Reserve is charged with promoting a healthy economy. Broadly speaking, an economy with low unemployment, low and stable inflation, and a financial system that meets the economy's needs for credit and other services without being itself a source of instability. We pursue these goals through a variety of means. Together with other federal supervisory agencies, we oversee banks and other financial institutions. We monitor the financial system as a whole for possible risks to stability. We encourage financial and economic literacy, promote equal access to credit, and advance local economic development by working with communities, nonprofit organizations, and others around the country. We also provide some basic services to the financial sector, for example, by processing payments and by distributing currency and coin to banks. But today I want to focus on a role that is particularly identified with the Federal Reserve, the making of monetary policy. The goals of monetary policy, maximum employment and price stability, were given to us by the Congress. These goals mean basically that we'd like to see as many Americans as possible who want jobs to have jobs, and that we aim to keep the rate of increase in consumer prices low and stable. In normal circumstances, the Federal Reserve implements monetary policy through its influence on short-term interest rates, which in turn affect other interest rates and asset prices. Generally, if economic weakness is the primary concern, the Fed acts to reduce interest rates, which supports the economy by inducing businesses to invest more in new capital goods and by leading households to spend more on houses, autos, and other goods and services. And likewise, if the economy is overheating, the Fed can raise interest rates to help cool demand and constrain inflationary pressures. So following this standard textbook approach, the Fed cut short-term interest rates rapidly during the financial crisis, reducing them nearly to zero by the end of 2008, a time, as you will recall, when the economy was contracting sharply. At that point, however, we faced a real and novel challenge. Once at zero, short-term interest rates could not be cut further, and so our traditional policy for dealing with economic weakness was no longer available. And yet, with unemployment soaring, the economy and the job market clearly needed more support. Central banks around the world found themselves in a similar predicament. And so we asked ourselves, what do we do now? Well, to answer this question, we could draw on the experience of Japan, where short-term interest rates have been near zero for many years, as well as a good deal of academic work. Unable to reduce short-term interest rates further, we looked instead for ways to influence longer-term interest rates, which had remained well above zero. We reasoned that, just as with traditional monetary policy, bringing down longer-term interest rates should support economic growth and employment by lowering the cost of borrowing to buy homes and cars or to finance investments. And since 2008, we've used two types of less traditional monetary policy tools to help bring down longer-term interest rates. The first of these less traditional tools involves the Fed purchasing longer-term securities on the open market, principally Treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities guaranteed by the government-sponsored enterprises such as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The Fed's purchases reduced the amount of longer-term securities held by investors and put downward pressure on the interest rates on those securities. That downward pressure transmits to a wide range of interest rates that individuals and businesses pay. For example, when the Fed first announced purchases of mortgage-backed securities in late 2008, 30-year mortgage interest rates averaged a little bit above 6%. Today, they average about 3.5%. Lower mortgage rates are one reason for the improvement we've been seeing in the housing market, which in turn is benefiting our economy more broadly. Other important interest rates, such as corporate bond rates and rates on auto loans, have also been declining. Lower interest rates also put upward pressure on the prices of assets, such as stocks and homes, providing further impetus to household and business spending. The second monetary policy tool that we've been using involves communicating our expectations for how long short-term interest rates will remain exceptionally low. Because the yield on, say, a 5-year security embeds market expectations for the course of short-term rates over the next 5 years, convincing investors that we will keep short-term rates low for a longer time can help to pull down market-determined longer-term interest rates. In sum, the Fed's basic strategy for strengthening the economy, reducing interest rates, and easing financial conditions more generally, is the same as it's always been. The difference is that with the short-term interest rate nearly at zero, We have shifted to tools that are aimed at reducing longer-term interest rates more directly. Last month, my colleagues and I used both tools, securities purchases and communications about our future actions, in a coordinated way to further support the recovery in the job market. Why did we act? Though the economy has been growing since mid-2009, and we expect it to continue to expand, it simply has not been growing fast enough recently to make significant progress in bringing down unemployment. At 8.1%, the unemployment rate is nearly unchanged since the beginning of the year and is well above normal levels. While unemployment has been stubbornly high, our economy has enjoyed broad price stability for some time, and we expect inflation to remain low for the foreseeable future. So the case seemed clear to most of my colleagues that we could do more to assist economic growth in the job market without compromising our goal of price stability. So specifically, what did we do? On securities purchases, we announced that we would buy mortgage-backed securities guaranteed by the government-sponsored enterprises at a rate of $40 billion per month. Those purchases, along with the continuation of a previous program involving Treasury securities, mean we are buying $85 billion of longer-term securities per month through the end of the year. We expect these purchases to put further downward pressure on longer-term interest rates, including mortgage rates. To underline the Federal Reserve's commitment to fostering a sustainable economic recovery, we said that we would continue securities purchases and employ other policy tools until the outlook for the job market improves substantially in a context of price stability. In the category of communications policy, we also extended our estimate of how long we expect to keep the short-term interest rate at exceptionally low levels to at least mid-2015. That doesn't mean that we expect the economy to be weak through 2015. Rather, our message was that so long as price stability is preserved, we will take care not to raise rates prematurely. Specifically, we expect that a highly accommodative stance of monetary policy will remain appropriate for a considerable time after the economy strengthens. We hope that by clarifying our expectations about future policy, we can provide individuals, families, businesses, and financial markets greater confidence about the Federal Reserve's commitment to promoting a sustainable recovery, and that as a result, they will become more willing to invest, hire, and spend. Now, as I've said many times, monetary policy is no panacea. It can be used to support stronger economic growth in situations as today, in which the economy is not making full use of its resources, and it can foster a healthier economy in the longer term by maintaining low and stable inflation. However, many other steps could be taken to strengthen our economy over time, such as putting the federal budget on a sustainable path, reforming the tax code, improving our educational system, supporting technological innovation, and expanding international trade. Although monetary policy cannot cure the economy's ills, particularly in today's challenging circumstances, we do think that it can provide meaningful help. And so we at the Federal Reserve are going to do what we can do and trust that others in both the public and the private sectors will do what they can do as well. Well, that brings me to the second question. What's the relationship between monetary policy and fiscal policy? To answer this question, it may help to begin with a more basic question of how monetary policy and fiscal policy differ. In short, monetary policy and fiscal policy involve quite different sets of actors, decisions, and tools. Fiscal policy involves decisions about how much the government should spend, how much it should tax, and how much it should borrow. At the federal level, those decisions are made by the administration and Congress. Fiscal policy determines the size of the federal budget deficit, which is the difference between federal spending and revenues in a year. Borrowing to finance budget deficits increases the government's total outstanding debt. As I've discussed, monetary policy is the responsibility of the Federal Reserve, or more specifically, the Federal Open Market Committee, which includes members of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors and presidents of Federal Reserve Banks. Unlike fiscal policy, monetary policy does not involve any taxation, transfer payments, or purchases of goods and services. Instead, as I mentioned, monetary policy mainly involves the purchase and sale of securities. The securities that the Fed purchases and in the conduct of monetary policy are held in our portfolio and earn interest. The great bulk of those interest earnings are sent to the Treasury, thereby helping reduce the government deficit. In the past 3 years, the Fed has remitted $200 billion to the federal government. Ultimately, the securities held by the Fed will mature or will be sold back into the market. So the odds are high that the purchase programs that the Fed has undertaken in support of the recovery will end up reducing, not increasing, the federal debt, both through the interest earnings that we send to the Treasury and because a stronger economy tends to lead to higher tax revenues and reduced government spending on unemployment benefits, for example. Even though our activities are likely to result in a lower national debt in the longer term, I sometimes hear the complaint that the Federal Reserve is enabling bad fiscal policy by keeping interest rates very low and thereby making it cheaper for the federal government to borrow. I find this argument unpersuasive. The responsibility for fiscal policy lies squarely with the administration and the Congress. At the Federal Reserve, we implement policy to promote maximum employment and price stability, as the law under which we operate requires. Using monetary policy to try to influence the political debate on the budget would be highly inappropriate. And for what it's worth, I think the strategy would also likely be ineffective. Suppose that, notwithstanding our legal mandate, the Federal Reserve were to raise interest rates for the purpose of making it more expensive for the government to borrow. Such an action would substantially increase the deficit, not only because of higher interest rates, but also because the weaker recovery that would result from premature monetary tightening would further widen the gap between spending and revenues. Would such a step lead to better fiscal outcomes? It seems likely that a significant widening of the deficit, which would make the needed fiscal actions even more difficult and painful, would worsen rather than improve the prospects of a comprehensive fiscal solution. I certainly don't underestimate the challenges that fiscal policymakers face. They must find ways to put the federal budget on a sustainable path, but not so abruptly as to endanger the economic recovery in the near term. In particular, the Congress and the administration will soon have to address the so-called fiscal cliff, a combination of sharply higher taxes and reduced spending that is set to happen at the beginning of the year. According to the Congressional Budget Office and virtually all other experts, if that were allowed to occur, it would likely throw the economy back into recession. The Congress and the administration will also have to raise the debt ceiling to prevent the Treasury from defaulting on its obligations, an outcome that would have extremely negative consequences for the country for years to come. Achieving these fiscal goals would be even more difficult if monetary policy were not helping to support the economic recovery. A third question, and an important one, is whether the Federal Reserve's monetary policy will lead to higher inflation down the road. In response, I'll start by pointing out that the Federal Reserve's price stability record is excellent, and we are fully committed to maintaining it. Inflation has averaged close to 2% per year for several decades, and that's about where it is today. In particular, the low interest rate policies the Fed has been following for about 5 years now have not led to increased inflation. Moreover, according to a variety of measures, the public's expectations of inflation over the long run remain quite stable and within the range they have been for many years. With monetary policy being so accommodative now, though, it's not unreasonable to ask whether or not we are sowing the seeds of future inflation. A related question I sometimes hear, which bears also on the relationship between monetary and fiscal policy, is this. By buying securities, are you, quote, monetizing the debt, printing money for the government to use, and will that inevitably lead to higher inflation? No, that's not what's happening, and that will not happen. Monetizing the debt means using money creation as a permanent source of financing for government spending. In contrast, we are acquiring Treasury securities on the open market and only on a temporary basis, with the goal of supporting the economic recovery through lower interest rates. At the appropriate time, the Federal Reserve will gradually sell these securities or let them mature as needed, to return its balance sheet to a more normal size. Moreover, the way the Fed finances its security purchases is by creating reserves in the banking system. Increased bank reserves held at the Fed don't necessarily translate into more money or cash in circulation, and indeed, broad measures of the money supply have not grown especially quickly on balance over the past few years. For controlling inflation, the key question is whether the Federal Reserve has the policy tools to tighten monetary conditions at the appropriate time so as to prevent the emergence of inflationary pressures down the road. I'm confident that we have the necessary tools to withdraw policy accommodation when needed, and that we can do so in a way that allows us to shrink our balance sheet in a deliberate and orderly way. For example, the Fed can tighten policy, even if our balance sheet remains large, by increasing the interest rate that we pay banks on reserves that they deposit at the Fed. Because banks will not lend at rates lower than what they can earn at the Fed, such an action should serve to raise rates and tighten credit conditions more generally, preventing any tendency towards overheating in the economy. Of course, having effective tools is one thing. Using them in a timely way, neither too early or too late, is another. Determining precisely the right time to take away the punch bowl is always a challenge for central bankers, but that's true whether they're using traditional or non-traditional policy tools. I can assure you that my colleagues and I will carefully consider how best to foster both of our mandated objectives, maximum employment and price stability, when the time comes to make those decisions. The concern about possible inflation is a concern for the future. One concern in the here and now is about the effect of low interest rates on savers and investors. My colleagues and I know that people who rely on investments that pay a fixed interest rate, such as certificates of deposit, are receiving very low returns, a situation that has involved significant hardship for some. However, I would encourage you to remember that the current low level of interest rates, while in the first instance a reflection of the Federal Reserve's monetary policy, is in a larger sense the result of the recent financial crisis, the worst shock to the nation's financial system since the 1930s. Interest rates are low throughout the developed world, except in countries experiencing fiscal crises, as central banks and other policymakers try to cope with continuing financial strains and weak economic conditions. A second observation is that savers often wear many economic hats. Many savers are also homeowners. Indeed, a family's home may be its most important financial asset. Many savers are working, or would like to be. Some savers own businesses, and through pension funds and 401k accounts, they often own stocks and other assets. The crisis and recession have led to very low interest rates, that's true. But these events have also destroyed jobs, hamstrung economic growth, and led to sharp declines in the values of many homes and businesses. So what can be done to address all of these concerns simultaneously? The best and most comprehensive solution is to find ways to get a stronger economy. Only a strong economy can create higher asset values and sustainably good returns for savers. And without a job, people won't be able to buy a home or pay for an education, irrespective of the current level of interest rates. And strong economies mean more jobs. The way for the Fed to support a return to a strong economy is by maintaining monetary accommodation, which requires low interest rates for a time. If, in contrast, the Fed were to raise rates now before the economic recovery is fully entrenched, house prices might resume their declines, the values of businesses large and small would drop, and critically, unemployment would likely start to rise again. Such outcomes would ultimately not be good for savers or for anyone else. Let me turn finally to the question of how the Federal Reserve is held accountable in a democratic society. The Federal Reserve was created by the Congress now almost a century ago. In the Federal Reserve Act and subsequent legislation, the Congress laid out the central bank's goals and powers, and the Fed is responsible to the Congress for meeting its mandated objectives, including fostering maximum employment and price stability. At the same time, the Congress wisely designed the Federal Reserve to be insulated from short-term political pressure. For example, members of the Federal Reserve Board are appointed to staggered 14-year terms, with the result that some members may serve through several administrations. Research and practical experience have established that freeing the central bank from short-term political pressures leads to better monetary policy making, because it allows policymakers to focus on what is best for the economy in the longer run, independent of near-term electoral or partisan concerns. All of the members of the Federal Open Market Committee take this principle very seriously and strive always to make monetary policy decisions based solely on factual evidence and careful analysis. It is important to keep politics out of monetary policy decisions, but it is equally important in a democracy for those decisions, and indeed all of the Federal Reserve's decisions and actions, to be undertaken in a strong framework of accountability and transparency. The American people have a right to know how the Federal Reserve is carrying out its responsibilities and how we are using taxpayer resources. One of my principal objectives as chairman has been to make monetary policy at the Federal Reserve as transparent as possible. We promote policy transparency in many ways. For example, the Federal Open Market Committee explains the reasons for its policy decisions in a statement released after each regularly scheduled meeting. And 3 weeks later, we publish minutes with a detailed summary of the meeting discussion. The committee also publishes quarterly economic projections with information about where we expect both the economy and policy to be over the next several years. I hold news conferences 4 times a year, and I testify often before congressional committees, including twice yearly appearances that are specifically designed for the purpose of my presenting a comprehensive monetary policy report to the Congress. My colleagues and I frequently deliver speeches, such as this one, in towns and cities across the country. The Federal Reserve is also very open about its finances and operations. The Federal Reserve Act requires the Federal Reserve to report annually on its operations and to publish its balance sheet weekly. Similarly, under the financial reform law enacted after the financial crisis, we publicly report in detail on our lending programs and securities purchases, including the identities of borrowers and counterparties, amounts lent or purchased, and other information such as collateral accepted. In late 2010, we posted detailed information on our public website and more than 21,000 individual credit and other transactions conducted to stabilize markets during the financial crisis. And just last Friday, we posted the first in an ongoing series of quarterly reports providing a great deal of information on individual discount window loans and securities transactions. The Federal Reserve's financial statement is audited by an independent outside accounting firm, and an independent inspector general has wide powers to review actions taken by the board. Importantly, the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, has the ability and does oversee the efficiency and integrity of all the Federal Reserve's operations, including our financial controls and our governance. While the GAO has access to all aspects of the Fed's operations and is free to criticize or make recommendations, there is one important exclusion: monetary policy making. In the 1970s, the Congress deliberately excluded monetary policy deliberations, decisions, and actions from the scope of GAO reviews. In doing so, the Congress carefully balanced the need for democratic accountability with the benefits that flow from keeping monetary policy free from short-term political pressures. However, there have been recent proposals to expand the authority of the GAO over the Federal Reserve to include reviews of monetary policy decisions. Because the GAO is the investigative arm of the Congress, and GAO reviews may be initiated at the request of members of Congress, these reviews or prospects to reviews of individual policy decisions could be seen with good reason as efforts to bring political pressure to bear on monetary policymakers. A perceived politicization of monetary policy would reduce public confidence in the ability of the Federal Reserve to make its policy decisions based strictly on what is good for the economy in the longer term. Balancing the need for accountability against the goal of insulating monetary policy from short-term political pressures is very important, and I believe that the Congress had it right in the 1970s when it explicitly chose to protect monetary policy decision-making from the possibility of politically motivated reviews. In conclusion, I will simply note that these past few years have been a difficult time for the nation and for the economy. For its part, the Federal Reserve has also been tested by unprecedented challenges. As we approach next year's 100th anniversary of the signing of the Federal Reserve Act, I want to say that I have great confidence in the institution. In particular, I would like to recognize the skill, professionalism, and dedication of the employees of the Federal Reserve System. They work tirelessly to serve the public interest and to promote prosperity for people and businesses across America. The Fed's policy choices can always be debated, but the quality and commitment of the Federal Reserve as a public institution is second to none, and I am proud to lead it. Well, now I've answered the questions I posed myself. I think it's time for me to take a few of yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Okay, we're going to get right into it. We've got a lot of questions. I've been monitoring both the questions we're getting via Twitter, and just as a reminder, you have these white cards on your table. If you have a question for Chairman Bernanke, the staff will be through to pick them up, or you can just bring them here to the front table. Mr. Chairman, you mentioned Japan and some of the things that we've learned from Japan. Can you expand a little bit on that? Over the last 20 years, the Japanese economy has gone through some of the things that we've experienced here in the United States. What have we learned from Japan, and what are the limitations of the lessons that we could learn from Japan?
Well, Japan, of course, was the first modern economy to be trapped at the zero bound, that is to have short-term interest rates close to zero. And in many ways, their experience foreshadowed the global financial crisis of 2008. Japanese had a stock market boom and bust and a property boom and bust together, which was roughly double the size, proportionally speaking, of what happened in the United States. And so it was a major shock to their economy. They have responded to it through a variety of tools. I think there are a couple things that we learned from watching their experience and the troubles and the difficulties they've been through, and two that I would point to that we have tried to learn from them. The first is aggressiveness, early aggressiveness of monetary policy. What we learned from Japan is we learned from the 1930s that once you get into deflation, a deflation is a situation where prices are dropping, prices and wages are dropping, it can be very, very hard to get out of that. And when you're in deflation, there's a lot of downward pressure on the economy. We were very aggressive early on in the United States to avoid deflation, and we have maintained inflation close to our 2% target, which is about where we think it ought to be, low enough so that it doesn't create major problems for businesses, markets, and so on, but high enough that we stay away from the deflation boundary, which is risky. The other thing which has been important is getting to your banking system and recapitalizing it and getting it back into operation as soon as possible. Japanese took a while to do that, and for a period of time, their banks were not extending credit. That lasted for a number of years. Now, financial crises are difficult for everybody. I don't mean in any way to minimize the difficulties. But what we tried to do in the United States was to address the problem of bank capital very early. So in the spring of 2009, when the economy was still deep in recession, financial crisis was still going on, the Federal Reserve led an effort to stress test all the largest bank holding companies in the United States and to determine how much capital they needed, not only to be stable, but also to be able to lend and support economic recovery. And whatever capital they didn't have, they had to go out and get. This was a very successful exercise. It restored a great deal of confidence in our banking system. Over the subsequent months, U.S. banks went out and raised several hundred billion dollars of new private capital. Since that time, well, of course, there's still difficulties in credit markets, and lending standards are still tight in some areas. Lending has shown recovery, a significant amount of recovery, and banks are back operating and providing credit to the economy. So those are some of the things we learned. But again, I don't want to in any way argue that the Japanese were facing anything other than an extraordinary situation. As I said, they were hit initially by a shock that was roughly twice the size of what we experienced.
So, Mr. Chairman, this is a city where the ideas of Milton Friedman continue to get a lot of attention. And one of our questions via Twitter asks how you think Milton Friedman might have viewed the Federal Reserve's evolving role over the last 5 years.
I think Milton Friedman, I'm a very big fan of Milton Friedman. I knew Friedman for a long time. I was a colleague of his for a while at Stanford. I've had many opportunities to talk to him. I spoke at his 90th birthday party. I spoke at several other events in his honor. He was a terrific economist, very insightful. I think he would have supported what we are doing. One of the things that made Friedman's reputation was his work with Anna Schwartz about the Great Depression. And they pointed to two basic problems, and they were very analogous to what I was just talking about in the context of Japan. They pointed to the deflation, the overly tight monetary policy of the period, and they pointed to the collapse of the banking system and said it was the failure of the Federal Reserve to address both of those problems that made the U.S. Depression as bad as it was. And we took that very much to heart. We were aggressive early on. We didn't allow the fact that interest rates were very low to fool us into thinking that monetary policy was as accommodative as it needed to be. And we were aggressive, as you know, in trying to prevent the collapse of our banking system. I think those are all things that Friedman would have supported. In addition, he very much supported providing enough liquidity to the economy so that the economy could grow and that inflation could be at a low and stable level. And in fact, about a dozen years ago, I think it was in the year 2000, Friedman was asked what the Japanese should do at that time, and he says, well, they ought to go out and buy securities, which is exactly what the Federal Reserve is doing now, trying to make sure there's enough liquidity in the system so that tightness in monetary policy, lack of liquidity, is not the constraint. Now, there are many other factors that are holding back our economy. We want to make sure that monetary policy is providing adequate support, and I think that Professor Friedman would have been very comfortable with that.
Can you talk a little bit about what's happening in Europe right now with respect to the fact that the European Central Bank and the central banks in various European countries have been taking action? How is that impacting our decision making here, and what relationship does that have in terms of the value of the dollar?
Well, we're watching the European situation very carefully. It has been a problem for the U.S. economy. We've seen headwinds coming from slowing trade and slowing economic activity in Europe, and the financial stresses tied to Europe have also affected our markets, our economy, and so we have a very strong interest in Europe solving its problems. In addition, they have so far avoided any real blow-up in their financial system, and we anticipate that they'll continue to avoid that. But if that were to happen, that, of course, would not be confined to Europe. Its effects would be felt around the world and certainly in the United States. So we've had a lot of interest in following that situation. It's a very difficult, complex situation, made more complex by the fact that instead of having a single government trying to decide how to solve these problems, they have 17 countries in the Eurozone, each one with its own parliament, each one with its own politics. And so the process of making decisions has been very difficult. The problem, a very simple way of looking at the problem, is that the 17 countries of the Eurozone have a single monetary policy. The European Central Bank and the Euro are analogous to the Federal Reserve and the dollar in the United States, but they have 17 different fiscal policies which are not able to support each other during a period of recession as they're currently in. So what's needed is some ongoing structural reforms that will, first of all, improve their cooperation and coordination on fiscal policy, and they're trying to do that. A second very useful step would be what they are calling banking union, which is essentially making bank supervision, deposit insurance, oversight, recapitalization responsibilities of Europe as a whole and not of each individual country. In order to get to that point, they've got to keep stability in the markets, and the ECB has done some very constructive things in terms of its long-term refinancing operations, in terms of the more recent proposals, to try to help keep markets stable, for at least a period of time. But the ECB's actions, as useful as they are not going to solve the problems. They're basically just going to provide time. And while the ECB provides time, it's very important that the governments of Europe work together to provide the structural changes that are necessary. We are pretty confident that the Europeans will rise to this challenge. They have very strong interest in preserving stability, preserving the euro. They have very strong political investment in the euro area and the European Union as ways of trying to create greater political comity in Europe. So there's a lot of incentive for them to get it done. But as I said, it's going to be a difficult task because of the fact that you are dealing with, within the eurozone, 17 sovereign nations, each with its own parliament, and then additional countries outside the eurozone in the European Union, which have influence on the broader policy decisions as well. So it's a difficult situation. We watch it very carefully because, as I said, it's not something that's happening over there. If problems increase in Europe, we will certainly feel them here in the United States.
Another question we have here is related to something that was said earlier this morning by an analyst suggesting that National Bureau of Economic Research will eventually proclaim that we're now already in recession. This person cited the drop in durable goods orders and the GDP dropping to 0.1% growth in the second quarter and other weak indicators. I think the question really is the declaration of recession is always a look back. Are there indicators that we are moving in a recessionary direction or, in fact, might already be there?
So I was once a member of the National Bureau of Economic Research, and I was on the little group there that called the 2001 recession, so I know how it happens. It sort of happens over a nice meal in a French restaurant, there's a discussion of the data, and everybody says, what do you think? Yeah, okay. December 2007 turning point, which I'm being a little bit light here, but it is a very careful analysis, but nevertheless, it's an imprecise analysis. And the termination of the December 2007 turning point didn't happen until like a year after the supposed turning point. It's just very, very hard to identify turning points in real time. And the NBER looks back, a year or more to try to determine whether key variables have moved in that direction. So given that caveat that nobody really knows until maybe some time has passed, right now we see an economy which is expanding. We see employment, which is one of the key indicators of recession, still growing. So we expect the economy to continue to grow. That's our best forecast as of now. So we are not expecting a recession. That being said, with an economy which is growing only sort of 1.5 to 2%, that is not fast enough to lower the unemployment rate. That is my concern. If the economy is growing a trend or below trend, that's just enough to help provide jobs for new people coming into the labor force. It doesn't do anything to eat into the backlog of the unemployed. And so our unemployment rate of 8.1% currently is really about the same as it was in January. We're not really making progress, at least not this year. We haven't made much progress. So our concern is not really a recession. Our concern is that growth will continue, but at a pace that's insufficient to put people back to work. And the longer we go with millions of people out of work, and more than 40% of those unemployed have been unemployed for at least 6 months, the more people we're going to have whose skills are going to atrophy, whose ability to find work is going to decline, and we'll be creating a permanent group of people who are not fulfilling their full potential in the labor force. And that, I think, is very, very costly. So that is one of the reasons, perhaps the key reason, why the Fed has taken action to try to help support the recovery.
So sticking with the somewhat lighter vein for a moment, we've got a surprising number of questions about baseball because of your known devotion to the field. So I feel compelled to ask you one baseball question. Can we learn anything about the dramatic success of the Nationals that might apply broadly to economic policy or monetary policy specifically, or vice versa?
You know, I keep these two issues in different compartments of my mind. So I've been a baseball fan for a long time, and I've noticed economists tend to be baseball fans. I think we like the numbers, you know, all the statistics and stuff. I don't know. I think the success of the Washington team, and I want to say here and now that I've been following them since 2005. I'm not a Johnny-come-lately just because they're having a good year. So we've been through a lot of pain as they have improved over time. I think, you know, I think what they've done is they've, if they look to the future, they, even when they were really bad, they were trying to hire, scout, you know, sign young players and look towards the future. And I think that's what our economy is all about. We have to look towards the future. We have to think about where we're going to be. We have to make sure our kids are educated so that they're able to contribute to a strong economy. We have to make sure that we're doing the capital, both public and private investment, we need to have a strong economy. So I think a future orientation, you know, not always looking backwards, not just looking at the one lost record this year, is the secret of their success. And I think it's an important thing for economic policymakers to think about as well.
So a lot of questions about the dollar, and I guess the best way to sum up these questions would be, what are your concerns about the value of the dollar, and maybe related, have the various quantitative easing efforts at some point, won't they drive down the value of the dollar? Is there sort of a natural limit to how much we can do before there's an impact on the dollar?
So when people talk about the dollar, they often confuse two very different ideas, and I think it's important to distinguish them a little bit. The first idea is the buying power of the dollar. How much can the dollar buy in terms of goods and services when you go to the grocery store, when you, you know, go to the mall, wherever you're shopping. And the measure of the dollar that matters for that definition is inflation. And I talked about inflation in my speech. Inflation in the United States has been about 2% now since the mid-90s. The markets expect inflation to stay around 2% going forward. People are willing to lend money to the U.S. government for 30 years for less than 3%. And that doesn't sound like a situation where the markets are really expecting high inflation in the future. So I think inflation, obviously we pay very close attention to it. Price stability is critical. But our record has been really good. We're looking at it very carefully. The markets show a lot of confidence in us. And so I'm not too concerned about the dollar on that definition. The other definition of the dollar has to do with the foreign exchange value. And this, you think about this when you go take a trip to Europe. You know, how many euros does my dollar buy? How many whatever other currency that you're trading for? And there I would argue that in the medium term, our policies are good for that dollar measure as well. First of all, I just note the facts. The facts are that since the crisis or before the crisis, the dollar has gone up and down for various reasons. The biggest factor affecting the dollar, frankly, has been fear. When people have become very afraid of a financial situation or of Europe or whatever, they pile into the dollar and the dollar strengthens. That's been the biggest factor. Risk on and risk off has been the biggest factor affecting the dollar. But putting aside those swings associated with risk on and risk off, safe haven flows, the dollar is about where it was before the crisis now. It hasn't really changed very much in broad terms. And moreover, going forward, the Fed's mandate, you recall, is price stability and maximum employment. Price stability means low inflation. That supports the value of the dollar. And maximum employment means a strong economy. And a strong economy means an economy where people will want to invest, where returns are high, where money will flow in. And those will be the things that support the dollar in the medium to long term. So I don't see any inconsistency with our policy and maintaining a strong dollar.
We've got time for one more question, and I wanted to make sure we got a question in about unemployment, because I think it's a question that a lot of people are thinking about. Have you been surprised that the policies that have been implemented in the last few years and haven't had a greater impact on the unemployment rate? And what, in your mind, are the main explanations for why unemployment is still at the level that it's at?
Well, at some level, the issue is not unemployment itself, it's the fact that the economy hasn't grown that fast. The unemployment rate has come down about as much or even a little more than you might expect it would given the speed of growth of the economy overall. As I was saying before, if the economy is growing a trend or less, you're just not going to see much progress in unemployment. So the real question is not, is there something wrong with the labor market? I don't think there's anything in particular wrong with the labor market. I think the question is, why isn't the economy growing faster? And here, I just think there are a number of headwinds, which I talked about in more detail in my remarks at Jackson Hole about a month ago. There are financial issues early on. There were, of course, the credit and financial instability issues that we had that were dragging down the economy. I think Europe is now part of the problem. The uncertainty about Europe is feeding through to a number of our financial variables. So that's one factor. A second factor is fiscal issues, particularly at the state and local area governments. People, maybe not, if you're involved in state government here, you might be aware of this, I'm sure you're aware of it, but state and local governments have been contracting very sharply, laying off tens of thousands of people, cutting spending back. So the overall fiscal situation, and then when you add to that uncertainties about the fiscal cliff, et cetera, I think fiscal issues have been part of the reason for slow growth. A third one is housing. We did have a double whammy. We had a financial crisis and a housing bubble. They were connected, obviously, but we had a 30% decline in house prices and a big drop in house construction and house sales. So for a long time, that was a major drag on the economy as well. And normally, in a recovery, you would see housing as a big part of that recovery. You would see a strong housing sector. And so far, we have seen now, we've begun to see improvement in housing, but obviously we're still not seeing the kind of strength in housing that we would normally see at this stage in the business cycle. So there are a number of factors you can point to that help explain why the recovery has not been as fast as we had hoped, and the Federal Reserve was over-optimistic in terms of our forecasts of growth. But given that slow growth in output, it's not really so surprising that we haven't made more progress in unemployment. But again, as I was saying earlier, it's precisely because long-term unemployment is such a costly thing that we need to get the growth rate up, and that's what we're trying to do at the Federal Reserve.
Please join me in thanking Chairman Bernanke. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. Today's presentation will be broadcast locally here on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 FM on Monday, November 5th at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and it will also be available for download at WFYI.org. Please join us next month on Monday, November 12th, for a presentation from James Stewart, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist and, by the way, DePaul University alum. Information and tickets for each of this season's presenters and membership information can be found at economicclubofindiana.com. Thank you all very much for being here. Have a wonderful afternoon.
You've been listening to Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, part of the 2012-2013 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Next month at this time, join us for DePaul University graduate and journalist James Stewart. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Radio in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sharon Alseth.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.